My humanity is bound up in yours, for we can only be human together. Desmond Tutu. Bearing Witness, part of the Racial Reckoning Project, is a reflective dive into the events unfolding in this season of racial upheaval and, we hope, change. I'm Reverend Anthony Galloway.
And I'm independent journalist Georgia Fort.
As we begin this show, I want to let our audience know that this is officially our second to last episode of Bearing Witness. And so as we talk with our guests today and we get into some of the events and the developments in the trial of Kimberly Potter and other issues with Ms. Georgia, I want to thank you for having been with us in these community check-ins. So let's get started with our second to last episode of Bearing Witness. This week, as like we started out, we are in the space of reliving one of the tragedies that we experienced with the shooting of Dante Wright through the trial of Kimberly Potter. There's been a lot of developments, and folks have been watching everything from the seating of this jury to, of course, who's going to talk and whether, and even the question of whether or not Kimberly Potter would take the stand herself. You know, we have recently come through the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse and the conviction of those who murdered Ahmaud Arbery. There's a lot of attention about how, not only how this process goes, but again, looking right into the face of what the outcome is going to be. What does this mean for our society? There's a lot of questions that folks are having as we go through yet again a round of reliving this experience. I was there, Miss Georgia, when we were out trying to cover different things. I remember being there at the vigil for the family, along with other clergy, helping to hold space for them to have time at the memorial site, and that they had taken the spare fist to the monument site. There's a lot going on. So catch us up, because I know you've been wall-to-wall trial coverage yet again, as we started out. So catch us up on what you've been experiencing witnessing this.
Well, Anthony, I know that there was a very emotional first week for the beginning of the trial with Dante Wright's mother taking the stand, the young woman who was in the vehicle with Dante Wright when he was fatally shot. She took the stand. And some of the responding officers, you know, they took the stand as well. The footage we saw of from their body cameras revealed a lot. I know some folks didn't realize that Dante Wright crashed into another car after he was shot. Some folks didn't know that there was an officer who was trailing behind that car he crashed into. And when that officer got out, he drew his gun on the young lady who was in the car with him, demanding that Dante Wright put his hands up, not knowing that he was unresponsive or at that point maybe even dead. And so a lot of evidence to take in, a lot of new information, but just hearing the emotional testimony of Katie Wright was hard. And hearing the young woman who was in the vehicle with him, knowing she was stuck in that car with him for at least 10 minutes after he died, it was really hard, you know. And Anthony, these trials always also bring forth a lot of information out about the person who is deceased that a lot of times is not complimentary for them. And so in our community, we hear this a lot, you know, that this isn't the Dante Wright trial. This is the Kimberly Potter trial. And we should be examining evidence, based on her actions, not based on the past of the individual who's no longer here. And so it's been re-traumatizing for our community, I think, in a lot of ways to have to relive that day and to hear all of this evidence that, you know, people weren't aware of contributing to the incident, but also contributing to Dante Wright's past.
You know, some of the parishioners at the church I pastor in Duluth were showing signs of real deep apprehension coming in yet again, mostly around what's going to happen along the thread that you just shared there. In terms of the besmirching of Dante Wright's character, especially when the defense comes forward, just because of what we've seen in past trials. Are you seeing that even as we learn more, you know, about Dante Wright and the prosecution's case here, are you anticipating that the defense is going to try to take a similar tact to in the case of the murder of George Floyd? Are you seeing kind of signs that, are there any hints that we're seeing that the defense is going to try to take that tactic?
Well, what I do think people can anticipate is them portraying this as a full-on accident. And we've already heard some foreshadowing of that happening with Kimberly Potter expected to take the stand. And in the jury instructions that have been published on the Hennepin County Court website, there is a one lone page of instructions on top of other instructions. There's one lone page that has one sentence that says, just because someone, you know, has an accident doesn't mean that they've committed a crime. And so I think more so than in the case of Derek Chauvin, the defense is leaning into that this was accidental. Mm-hmm. And obviously in the case with Derek Chauvin, for him to use excessive force, what was determined excessive force for 9 minutes and 29 seconds was not accidental. The prosecution in that case was able to prove that it was intentional and excessive. So in this case, you know, the defense is really leaning in on she made a mistake. And the chief of police, also contrary in the Derek Chauvin case, is going to back her. Mm. You know, with Chauvin, we saw Arredondo take the stand and testify against Chauvin. In this case, we're expecting the former Brooklyn Center police chief to actually testify for Kimberly Potter's decision.
So, I mean, just setting the context, this is a very different case with very different circumstances. And so, you know, one of the interesting conversations that have been had in some of the community spaces I've been in, and even doing some work in New York where folks are like, so, you know, So tell us more, you know, trying to grapple with the fact that there are some very different circumstances at play here. And I guess one of the things that were on folks' minds is what are you seeing in particular on the ground in terms of what this case represents in terms of suggestions for what should be different?
Well, you know, Anthony, Minneapolis was ground zero after George Floyd was murdered. And there were so many conversations about change and police accountability. This trial is a continuation of that conversation. What happens when an unarmed Black man is killed by police in Hennepin County, right? And I know people might look at what happens in Minneapolis very different than what happens in St. Paul, but like collectively as a community, this is the Twin Cities area. But also, Anthony, we saw over the last week or so, Arredondo come out publicly and say that he is not going to be holding that position anymore. And so these are all, you know, things that people are following, people who are passionate about police accountability and people who really felt like they wanted change in those areas.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. You know, it's an interesting time yet again when we've talked with community members about the what instability brings forward, and the sense of instability. There's a very interesting, nuanced, contextual story for Chief Arredondo and the police chief in St. Paul, who was also retiring,
and the Hennepin County Sheriff, who publicly admitted that he was drinking and driving when he got into a one-person crash.
it's interesting the pattern that there's never just one thing at a time. And that has been made very clear by not just your coverage, but even also the coverage of community members. So you know, before we bring on our guests, I'm curious, Miss Georgia, as we again come back to, so what will be different, and what is different now than when we began this journey? And what are you seeing down the pipeline? We've seen some, you know, small legislative changes. We've seen some things not go. We've seen some legislation not make it through, and folks have been concerned about that. We've seen the death of children as violence continues to rack parts of our community. We saw major cases elsewhere across the country happen. We got Dante right in the same week that we were awaiting the verdict in the Chauvin trial. So there's a lot of compounding things. There's a lot that has happened in the last several months as we began this journey down. I'm curious, as you do a kind of a look back, what are some things that you're starting to crystallize and take away from this season that we've had here on Bearing Witness?
This will be a season that is talked about in 20 years from now, that the decisions that are being made now are laying the foundation for what will be. And so I still feel like we are in the center of a historic era, but it's undeniable that we have a number of members in our community who are advocating for things to change, not just in terms of police accountability, police reform, but also within the criminal justice system. Because when you look back, even 10 years ago in Minnesota, it was unlikely that an officer would even be charged in instances of fatal uses of force. And so there has been some progression for those advocating for police accountability. People who are hoping for change that produces more equitable outcomes for people of color. I truly hope that those people who are advocating for that continue to stand up, and that they're relentless in their pursuit. Because regardless of if we're a journalist, if we are a radio announcer, if we're a police officer, regardless of what profession we have, if we are a person of color, we will be affected. If we don't get those changes, we will be affected if we do get those changes. And so I try to present the stories and the information from a neutral standpoint, leading with the facts. But at the end of the day, I'm a Black woman. And if we don't get change, I am not exempt from the disparities, the inequities, and the problems that has led our community to this point.
Thank you for doing that look back, Georgia, because I think it's important that your work, Bearing Witness, literally, as one of the lead journalists of this project, has been able to give that contextual nuance and to ask questions that we don't necessarily see asked in mainstream media sources. We had Freddie Bell on previously, who was one of the impetus of the Racial Reckoning Project and one of the essential pieces that needed to be here. But one of the other essential pieces that needed to be here was the Minnesota Humanities Center, in particular, the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center, Kevin Lindsay, who came early on and is one of the folks who made this amazing project to cover and bear witness through the journalism, through the check-in with community here on Bearing Witness, and all the pieces around it. And so I want to bring in our guest, Kevin Lindsay, who I think, Kevin, were you the first guest that we had on Bearing Witness?
Mm-hmm.
You were either the first or the second.
He was the first.
You were the first guest. So I love it as we think about the kind of bookends. You know, this is our second to last episode of Bearing Witness in this project. And so I think it's apropos to bring you in and talk to you a little bit. As you hear Georgia kind of recounting what's happening and what developments are there in the Potter trial, and you hear us talk a little bit about, as we look back a little bit, I'm curious what's been coming to your mind as you heard us recap some of those things.
Well, first off, Anthony and Georgia, thank you so much again for inviting me to be a part of this conversation around Bearing Witness. And also let me congratulate you and Ali as well for the outstanding work that you have been doing in this space. It is really been a blessing for us, I think, in Minnesota to have the three of you do great work within this space. This case that we're currently dealing with, I don't think it is going to be actually one in which you can kind of take a look at it and say what happened in Chauvin can easily be transferable, and we can clearly see a path or a line forward from Chauvin to Potter to be able to say, yes, we know what the end result will be. I think the fact that she was allowed to retire as well is significant. And I think the idea that we have newspapers that are sharing information and kind of coloring the way in which maybe the community might be thinking about an accident very differently than someone being on someone's neck for the intolerable amount of time. And I think we need to be prepared that that jury might come to a very different conclusion using thinking about it in that way. How we talk about victims, this idea that in order to achieve justice, there has to be such a huge burden borne by the African-American community, which does not have to be borne, unfortunately, by many other communities. We are constantly having to re-educate, rehabilitate, and ensure that the victim does not get dragged through the mud within these types of cases. So the work that you've been doing here, I think, has really been illustrative of that, and hopefully that will change the way in which people think about these cases going forward. And then I think the last thing is this about specifically police officers and interactions with African Americans, or is this a larger conversation about public safety? And how do we think about public safety and what does that mean? So again, highlighting some of the stories, even about how we select juries, how we think about other things within the community, this conversation about raising your voice and being able to protest, I think is really significant as well. You can't, in a democracy, truly fully be a participant if you don't have the ability to raise your voice and to be advocate for yourself. And unfortunately, when issues are tough like this, it feels like the larger society to some degree is willing to tolerate the silencing or the muffling of our voice as we seek to ensure full citizenship.
Yeah. And, you know, with that being said, you know, when you contrast the verdict in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, traveled state lines, killed two protesters, shot another, was found not guilty. You contrast that with, you know, even what happened here in Minneapolis with a car driving through and the police saying that they're not going to follow up with that driver because the protest didn't have a permit and so no crime was committed. You're seeing these examples where the attacks against people who are standing up and using their First Amendment right for Black causes, for Black life. And you're seeing these attacks against those people, and there's no consequence or repercussion. In some instances, it seems like it's discouraging people. It's creating dangerous environments for people to advocate on these causes. From a legal standpoint, because I know you have a legal background, you know, what advice could you give to people who want to safely use their First Amendment right to protest, but they're concerned with these, you know, recent instances and attacks?
Well, I will say that this is a very interesting time in which we find ourselves in. And I appreciate the work that you're doing, Georgia, to highlight some of the issues and challenges that protesters have. Your comments about speaking out, and especially as an independent journalist, getting information about where protesters can protest, I do appreciate the work of some cities as well about working with groups that want to raise their voice to make the permitting process to get a right to permit to protest simplified. goes a long way as well. But there's no doubt that given the court case that is currently pending before the Supreme Court about the right to bear arms or the right to carry arms, is whether that's a constitutionally protected right, potentially could have a dramatic chilling effect on the ability to protest, especially in light of the Rittenhouse decision. It's just unfortunately too early to tell what's the best strategy going forward, I think, until we see how the Supreme Court comes down in that case.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, with special guest Kevin Lindsay, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. As a pastor, one of the things that I am and confronted with from parishioners and community members often are the anxieties that come about with some of the legislative fights and battles that are in front of us. And as we near the anniversary of Sandy Hook and some of the vigils that are getting ready, that question around the Supreme Court case definitely came up amidst other concerns around and this notion of criminalizing the things that will that and the activities that are trying to produce changes that may make us uncomfortable. But one of the other things that are right here that are right in the precipice here is discomfort being at the same level of real data that we see that is resulting in death and real harm. This is a disturbing pattern for me that I think the work of the Humanities Center and the work of telling these stories and humanizing these stories becomes so important is we're in this dangerous space of somebody's sense or assumption of discomfort being put and defended at the same level as the actual results, the actual negative impacts that we see physically, emotionally, and all these other things. And it's a false dichotomy that is problematic to me. And so I'm curious where you see points, you know, where you see this kind of cutting through, where you see places that are trying to shatter that are trying to combat that in from your vantage point.
No, we live in a time where there is a tremendous amount of cognitive dissonance, right? Mm-hmm. So what most psychologists would tell you is trying to directly address that sometimes is not the most effective way for the individual to be able to hear and be able to see facts and to be able to reason toward a viewpoint which is shared by more individuals as to the facts that are before them. So this is why it's really important for all of us, regardless of the situation where we're in, whether that's family, whether that's our church, whether that's our place of work, to be engaged in a way that is not threatening to the individual, but continues to ask and continues to prod as it relates to why people hold on to certain beliefs or why are these certain facts ones that they find comfort within. It's clear that in the last 10 to 15 years, we've had more of a segregation of who we listen to, right? Mm-hmm. So to this extent, if I only listen to and I stay within my bubble, right, it becomes harder for me to accept other views, other facts that I potentially see if it's not agreed upon by the people who are kind of in my opinion or conversation bubble. But the challenge, of course, right, is that it's comforting to, right, to always be in that space. I think for the vast majority of us, we see a breakdown. We see cognitive dissonance taking hold at a whole different level than what has really happened. It's hard to imagine a time period where it has been more evident and more problematic than it has now been in our country. That's why I really appreciate projects like this. I really appreciate artists creating art to speak to this moment and challenging people's assumption. I really appreciate teachers and educators who are willing to wade into this space and try to change the way in which folks think about these respective issues. And then I respect tremendously the people who might not even be in what we traditionally consider positions of leadership or authority, wading in. Because it really will take all of us to get to a better place.
I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are. I mean, obviously, you've taken action by investing and supporting projects like the Racial Reckoning Project. What do you think other people can do? What are some other measures that individuals in the community, leaders in the community, can take to help move the needle forward on some of these issues?
Yeah, so I think projects like what we had, we have a project called How Can We Breathe, where you have a moderator, in this case, Rose McGee, a sweet potato comfort pie. Then we had a little bit of a recipe of food. It doesn't have to be sweet potato pie, but Rose would encourage that for sure. So in the four cities that we partnered with, we broke bread in the form of sweet potato pie with folks. So it was another opportunity to be engaged, create dialogue, friendship outside of the particular issue that brought us all together. And then you got to stay with it. So now after we did How Can We Breathe, we're now back in these four cities where we had these conversations virtually, but we're still back in those cities now with Love and Struggle and Right on Race. So now it's another opportunity to come back to it. It's a time to be reflective and allow people to write and also to communicate with others how we move forward on this racial reckoning time.
Brother Kevin Lindsay, I thank you so much for being with us, for being a part of launching this project and this work to do a new thing. And to kind of move the needle and say, hey, there's a different way to do things out here, and we are going to support that work. And so I really appreciate you and the support of being able to do that. We close our show with our motto every week. And so you were the first, and we're going to give it over to Ms. Georgia to close us out right.
In the words of Dr. Joy Lewis, may the revolution be healing.
Georgia, you and Anthony continue to be part of that healing. Thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate you. So for the listeners here, this is our second to the last show. And so we invite you to join us next week as Ms. Georgia and I together do some recap, do some connecting on kind of our next steps in different areas as we continue to do that work, but then also kind of capstone this community check-in side of the Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice Project. So we invite you to join us for our final episode next week, whether you're downloading this podcast or hearing us on one of the many Ampers radio stations. Make sure that you take some time for yourself to ask yourself, how are you being you in this moment? We'll see you next week.
Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia is a production of Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, a journalism project created and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio, the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.